Let me say something about the Leveson method, okay? About the total variation. Minimizing the total variation we got an equation that looks like that as a gradient descent. Now there is some difficulty in trying to numerically approximate something in which you divide by a magnitude of the gradient, where the magnitude of the gradient could vanish, could be equal to zero. So usually, and I think I mentioned it before, what people have been doing are introducing something like that. Okay, adding an epsilon to the denominator. In fact, if you look at it from a functional point of view, what you're optimizing now is with respect to the following metric. In a sense, you go up one dimension. I mean, this is the area of the function whose aspect ratio between the x coordinates and the intensity coordinate would be epsilon square. Okay? So in a sense, you are minimizing. I mean, this is nothing but the mean curvature of this surface. And the claim for the total variation was that if you stretch the intensity relatively high with respect to the x and y coordinates, what you do is the right thing. Okay? So this is where this epsilon is going to zero. This is what is going on. Now, this comes from a practical point of view. You would like to implement something which has intrinsic numerical difficulties in that. So can we do something like that and actually adopt it as a philosophy, as a philosophical way of treating images? So now let's go to a completely different arena, and this is the arena of color images. Okay, in color images, what is a color image? And can we actually look at this local difficulty or local problem and the remedy in order to generalize the whole philosophy of how should we actually process images? So from a philosophical point of view, the claim here is that the image should be sparse in a sense in the gradient in its gradient. Okay, but in this case, what we say is that images more or less tend to have minimal area or flow themselves towards a minimal area of the image. And the question is, can we take it further on and assuming that any input is given as an image, could we design a filter that would always apply to this kind of images? The answer is obviously no, but let me try to convince you that there is some reason when dealing with color images and perceiving color images as surfaces. I mean, if a two-dimensional image could be thought of as a surface, then why not color images? First of all, let's show some the difficulties in treating images as level sets. So should level sets would always be the right way to treat images? If you look at the left image, then this is a bright spot on a darker background. Level sets are great. They are exactly what we are looking for. This is what would segment the object from the background. Now assume that we add a tilted plane to this object and we get a level set which has nothing to do with the perceptual notion of what is an edge. Together with Nir Sohen, I spent some time in Berkeley Labs at the time, and we thought of why shouldn't we define images as mappings from XY to XY RGB space. I mean, think of an image as a two-dimensional manifold in its XY RGB space. Okay, how should we measure distances in this RGB space? So physicists more than 100 years ago tried to somehow quantify our perceptual notion of what is color by inventing colors, inventing measures that would quantify how much we are sensitive to small changes in color space. So the first one was a naive arc length proposed by Helmholtz, which is nothing but treat the RGB space as Euclidean space. Okay, the second one next followed Schrödinger, who thought that, look, when we dim I mean, when we lower the intensity of light in a room, we still can sense colors in more or less the same manner. So he normalized the color somehow. Stills invented something else. And eventually, let me tell you that at the end of the day, the color space in which we are using today is something that that is inductive. I mean, that is empirical. What researchers have done are putting people in front of a computer with two screens and starting manipulating the colors on the screens, and the person that the subject was saying was raising a flag whenever there was a change, wherever he could perceive a change between these two colors. Then all the values of these sensing tables were pushed into a multidimensional scalar, and at the end of the day, you could prove that human perception to color is more or less a two-dimensional process. Okay, so you could show that there is something like that, in which case, in along this band, you have all the monochromatic, all the lasers are mapped onto this one-dimensional curve, and all the interpolation between colors are inside this curve. Okay, and this is some abstract perceptual curve, A and B, and there is another axis which is nothing but the intensity. So our color perception can be mapped, can be simplified into a two-dimensional domain. In birds, for example, since they have more color sensors, probably the color sensing is a more complicated manifold. But since the dinosaurs, we lost one of the sensors. Actually, we lost two types of sensors, two types of cones, and we regained some of them when we started eating fruits. So in order to distinguish between fruits, we regained some of them, and now we have three sensors. I mean, conceptually, three color sensors and one gray level sensor, rods and cones. So it doesn't really matter how you define your sensitivity to color. The moment you have some arc length, some measure to your sensitivity to color, what you need to do in order to devise, in order to invent some mechanism is to connect, is to glue this arc length, this sensitivity arc length to color to space. Okay, so you need to combine these two measures together, and the question is how. So let's put a beta here, some ratio between these colors, between the color and the space. Okay, so we have a definition of distance in the XY perceptual space, and now we would like to invent something out of it. So before we do that, let us look at the simplest image formation model, and this is the Laubertian model that I described the other day. I mean, I described it from the point of view of shape from shading, but let's think about the simplest image formation model. So the color that we see is the dot product between the normal and the light source direction. This is the shading image, times the albedo, times some local property of the surface that tells the eye whether the surface is red, green, or blue, whatever. So for the red, green, and blue, we have three images. This part that varies in space is the shading image, and this part that specify, that is specific for each and every object, is called the albedo. So the apple would have probably the same albedo for the whole apple, but the shading would change a little bit. I mean, assuming that we eliminate the texture for a moment. So this is the simplest way of constructing an image. And let's see what can be done. So now we are given a noisy image, and we would like to denoise it. We would like to extract the best image that we can from a noisy image, assuming this oversimplistic formation model.
What's the connection with the
previous thing to the beta? There is no connection yet. What I will show you is the end of the day. So let me give you a brief of what is going to happen here. We have an arc length. From the arc length, we are going to define area. Now we are going to minimize this area. And I will show you that by minimizing the area, what we do is we take an image towards its simplistic form of being formed like that. Why? So this is the color image. This is the way it is formed. and these are the three images that we get: the dot product between the normal and the light source and the albedo. Okay. What we can see is that the gradients, I mean, since this number is constant per object and this number varies per object, if we take the gradient of each of these components, they should all agree at least in the direction. Okay? They should disagree, I mean, only the magnitude should change according to the albedos, to RGB. So obviously a blue image would have probably nothing to say in its red component, and vice versa. So the gradient of each element is nothing but the gradient of the shading image times the albedo, times some number. So if we get a dirty image, if we get a noisy image, what should we do? The gradient should probably would probably point in various strange directions. If, for example, you would take a JPEG image after it was compressed too much, you will see that along the boundaries you will see these kind of weird changing gradients that tend to create these weird effects, which is actually caused by the fact that the image was compressed in a non-natural space. So what you would like to do is untwist all these gradients so that they would all align together. Let's see what happens. Oh, this is constant per object. So CI is constant per object. And along the boundary, all of them should have the same direction anyhow. So basically, taking a gradient of a constant within an object, I can just delete it. Along the boundary, there is a drop in all of them towards the same direction. I mean, up to pi. CI is piecewise constant, in a sense. We can use this understanding in order, for example, to reconstruct images. I mean, in most of the modern sensors, at each and every pixel, we observe only one channel, either red, green, and blue. This is called the mosaic. It's called biopattern. Since our brain is more sensitive to the green, we give half of the pixels to the green, and then the rest of them are distributed evenly between the blues and the reds. So we get this sort of biopattern, and we would like to reconstruct back the continuous image from this sampling. We can use the previous understanding of what is going on in order to do this reconstruction. So this R here should be rho. So if we just take the ratio between these red and green images, it should be a constant. Okay, so we can use this fact in order to reconstruct, to upsample the image to its original. You can't see it very well, but what is going on here, we took an image, we threw away two-thirds of the information, and this is interpolation by some trivial bilinear interpolation. And if you are sensitive to the edges and do the right interpolation, you can go further away along the fence without violating some criteria and creating here some moiré patterns and aliasing effects. Okay, let me zoom in and show you what is going on. So you can see here something which is known as zipper effect and some other tricks. Well, if you are using this ratio that I've shown you before, you can go far away along the fence. By the way, the best algorithm these days are these sparsity, not sparsity, but rather dictionary learning algorithms. And in a sense, they are minimizing the same thing. I mean, sort of L1 home. Yet another example, an image by linear interpolation, and the using the criteria that I've shown you before, and indeed what we get is really eliminating all these zipper effects and non-natural reconstruction. Another example, original image by linear interpolation, zoom in. I don't know if you can see, but there are these kind of strange looking colors that should be eliminated by a better process. Okay. So we have our arc length, and I didn't yet tell you what is the beta. And from the arc length, we can extract the metric. And from the metric, I mean the square root of the determinant of the metric is nothing but the area of this surface. So in the one-channel case, what we had is nothing but the total variation. Okay, beta was very, very large. One was the epsilon, and what we got is the total variation. When we have And in this case, we just took the Helmholtz, original Helmholtz arc length, but you can take any other arc length. It would not, I mean, the subtleties would be minor. If you take another arc length, I mean, the metric in the RGB space, XY RGB space, then this is how the area would look like. Let's look at what is going on here. This part is exactly like the total variation. And there is another part which is, has an even greater influence, and that part is penalizing for what? This is the cross product. It's penalizing exactly for how much the red is departing from the blue. The red is departing from the green, etc., etc. So if I optimize, if I minimize the area of such an RGB image, then what should happen is, first of all the red, green, and blues should align together, should have the same gradient, and only then should start a total variation-like effect. So first of all, the image should become Lambertian, and only then we would start working on other stuff. Okay, so if beta is relatively large, we can throw away the one. If beta is relatively large, we can throw away the total variation part, and what we get is minimization of these gradients. So if this is a level set of the green function, of the green channel, and this is a level set of the red function, what I would do is optimize for the alignment of these two vector fields. Okay? So this is the first item that gets into action. This is the way to do that. I mean, for total variation, it's obvious. I mean, this is the epsilon. The one is the epsilon that you see over there. And the operator is nothing but the Beltrami operator. And by the way, note that we... But first of all, we had I of t equals to this div grad. Before that, we had c of t equals to div grad times the gradient of phi. And now what I'm telling you to do is, look, if you take the this mean curvature vector, what you can do is project it onto the intensity direction, into the RGB direction, and just take the component along the RGB direction, in a sense subtracting even more the influence of what is going on along the edges. Okay? And this is a legitimate, so think about going even one step further and doing something like that. Here you divide by 1 plus gradient of I square and take the square root of that, and here you have the div. Okay, so this would be an even more edge-preserving flow than that one. Okay, and this is nothing but the Laplace-Beltrami operator operating on the on a single channel, and this is Beltrami, and this is how he vanishes slowly into nothing. But you can see that information is degraded in a good manner. I mean, first of all the high frequency geometric noise is disappearing, and only then the more, let's call it, low frequency, low geometric frequency is disappearing. What happens in color space? In color space, we do exactly the same. So we apply the heat flow in RGB space, XY RGB space, and what you can see is that information disappears in a gradual manner, exactly as before, without disconnecting between the colors. I mean, if we zoom in into these R, G, and B and B channels, this is just rendering of the surfaces. This is how the flow. This is applying the flow for a little bit. You can see that. From a perceptual point of view, we don't generate any special colors along the boundary, which would be the case if I don't couple the three channels together properly. Okay, so it would first of all take us towards, yep.
What is the G metric?
The G is exactly what I've shown you before. So GAJ is nothing but one over beta, if you would like, and here you have RI RJ plus BI BJ plus RGB GI GJ. Okay, so this would be the metric. If you throw away the one, it's called, there is a name for it in image processing. It's called the structure tensor for the specific image. This is how the MATLAB program looks like. That's just to show that it's very simple to implement explicitly, as well as implicitly. I mean, just to show you that it's very efficient to write it in MATLAB. To run this equation, you feed it with a color image, and then it flows the image. It extracts the matrix. So let's see what is going on here. This is just the heat equation in RGB space. So it's not just the heat equation. It's just the heat equation like in total variation, which is just the heat equation. You see, this is the heat equation. I consider this to be the heat equation with respect to a specific metric. So it would be just in the same sense. All the problems that are here on the board are nonlinear problems. The metric depends on I.
Oh, I see. Okay, so it's not.
Well, you can fix G initially, but then you have to play with it. And okay, so philosophically, what are we doing here? So classically, computer, as you get a signal, Gaussian smoothing, I mean the heat equation in the linear sense, what you do is basically convolving with the Gaussian, and this is what happens. It would not preserve the edges. What we call Bertrami smoothing is using the signal itself as the support for the short time kernel. Okay, so in a sense, what we do is convolve with the Gaussian on the signal itself. So it would preserve the edges, and if we stretch the RGB space with respect to the XY coordinates, then this is exactly what would happen. I mean, and throw away two channels, this is exactly what would happen in the total variation case. So in a sense, it's a natural extension of the total variation to color space.
Is there a theoretical
proof that minimizing the area would preserve the channel? In what sense theoretical proof? Everything would vanish at the end, exactly like in total variation. Again? I mean, everything would vanish. This is an area minimization problem. So everything would vanish. It would be it is sort of a scale space. This is why I started from talking about scale space. It would disappear at the end. You can obviously add constraints or not constraints. I mean, some penalties. Constraints would do terrible things here, because in minimal surfaces, if you think about images, then if you just take two circles, one on top of the other, and take them apart, and you will have a catenoid, and then you will not be able to represent it as a function. So you need to put penalties inside. Okay? So minimal surfaces are not the best thing in images. But still. So this is what is going on, and this is why we call it the Bertrami smoothing. In fact, you can show that it is related from the point of view of image processing to non-local means, to bilateral. You mentioned bilateral, I think, before that. Bilateral is nothing but, if this is your signal, is taking a point, and in the exponent, instead of either like the Bertrami measuring the distance along the signal, or like the linear heat equation measuring the distance along the x direction, in the Bertrami, in the bilateral, what happens is that the distance is measured along this direction. Okay, so in the exponent, what you have is delta x squared plus delta I squared. Okay, minus some sigma here. Okay, this is what is going on in the bilateral filter, which is very popular in image processing. In non-local means, what is going on is that you look for a patch and find all the similar looking patches, and then you average by that. You can do Bertrami in what is known as patch space, by a notion introduced by Petros Maragos, and get something very similar, at least from a diffusion point of view, to the non-local means trick. But the moment you understand how to build an arc length and how to plug it into a heat equation, you can do nice things with images. For example, you can take an image, decompose it into its wavelet coefficients in some wavelet basis. In this case, we took something like Gabor-Mole wavelets, and then flow the Beltrami flow in that many-dimensional space. Okay, so it would preserve the orientation in this texture, for example. It would preserve the bricks, the shape of the bricks in this example, and you can start playing with that even further. In fact, if you understand the geometry behind what is going on, then you can start doing even terrible thing from a theoretical point of view. You can invert the diffusion along the direction of maximal dr square plus d, g square plus db square. I mean, across the edge, you can actually create some instabilities, deliberate instabilities that would generate patterns. It goes back, by the way, to a work by Gabor himself, who said that in order to use a computer, in his paper he writes a computer, to enhance images, what you need to do is, in fact, this is 64. I was 1 year old at the time. You need to do total variation. Okay? So you need to flow the image according to I eta eta. And you need to add some little epsilon along ix, ix, I. Okay? This should do the trick. This should give you better images. And he was talking about microscope imaging. And this is a very interesting paper. I mean, he was doing only one iteration, otherwise it would not be stable. But what we have done here is actually applied the same trick. So first of all, you can see that there is a little bit of enhancement, and then new patterns are generated. Obviously, if you invert the heat equation, then stability is completely lost. This is beyond the scope of pure mathematical analysis usually, but again, nice things happen before they start to blow up. Obviously, this is a positive feedback, okay? You can see here the image of the mandrill, in which, this is an enhanced version of that one, so you can see that the mandrill is looking for you in a much sharper look if you think about it non-objectively. Just to summarize, so we took the total variation as a nice thing to have, and we saw that what it actually does is minimizing the arc length, the area of a surface in XY intensity space. And we adopted this idea to color space and treated images as manifolds in this higher dimensional space. And then everything is working quite nicely. We have algorithms, they work. I think it was implemented in some products. I mean, I had so many students sitting in my course, so once or twice they told me that they implemented that in some products in the industry. There are many open questions. Some of them actually were closed. If there is a maximum principle in there, the Beltrami flow, so apparently there is, and Lorena Daskal proved something like that. In fact, it was very hard to come up with a numerical scheme that would satisfy this maximal principle, but she was able to do that. This was, I think, her PhD. There is no way to invert a geometric heat operator, so obviously the answer here is no, but at least experimentally we can do something with that. Real time, I mean, now with the evolution. Yes. So what you actually do is along one direction, this is exactly what you do, okay? What is written here. You take the Laplacian and you invert one of the directions. So it would be I eta eta minus I psi xi, and here add an epsilon so that we could feel good. Okay. Next. So if you have any questions about that chapter, if not, I wanted to go back to something I skipped over my first lecture, and there are two reasons for that. First of all, you showed too much interest in what happens when you lose geodesics, when boundary conditions change. So let me go back to the shape recognition problem, surface recognition problem, or shape matching problem, and introduce partialities as well as changes in topology. And the reason I'm going back to that is because in this case, we will introduce an we will use an interesting geometry in order to analyze these kind of problems. This is a little bit more nice to, there is a nice gain for that. So let's take the surface S and the surface Q, and this is the minimal geodesic connecting these two points. What would happen if I now hide part of this surface? Okay, I now crop part of the surface. The minimal geodesic that used to lead between these two points could now travel to its completely different route. And the question is what to do? How can I still match between S prime and Q? If there are questions, I'll be happy to answer at the back. I'll be happy to answer. If there are questions. So what should we do about something like that? How should we still compare between S prime and Q after we have cropped part of the surface? And the answer is almost trivial. What we need to do is throw away all the geodesics that we suspect could have changed due to this occlusion. Okay, and the way to do that is the following filtering idea, by which if the distance, the geodesic distance between a point and the boundary plus the geodesic distance between the other point and the boundary is smaller than the minimal geodesic connecting these two points, then we suspect that this geodesic is a wrong geodesic to use. And then we can throw it away, we can filter it out from the matching process. So we just apply this trivial filtering out mechanism to the intergeodesic distances matrix, and then we can do the partial matching. So if we do that, we take, in this case, parts of these objects and match them to the full objects, and we get a fairly good, yep. I don't know. Between these two points, I don't know the actual distance. But what I will know is that along this radius, I will have some support of the point SI here. And then there would be, the matrix of distances would be filled with distances that I rely on. I would just filter out the long ones, so the more I get close to the boundary, the less support I will get. I will include towards these points that are close to the boundary. The further I depart from the boundary, the more support I will have. So, excuse me. You can take out anything. In fact, we did it for manifold learning in high dimensions. If you just crop out this region and then that region, then obviously all the points here would have local support, okay? But between these two points, you will have a larger geodesic that can support the distance between them. Okay? So you would throw away all the suspected wrong geodesics. And in learning, it's very nice. What you do is you take a Swiss roll, which is something like that. You punch a hole in the middle. I think this is an example that Dave Donahoe liked. And then you show that all the classical manifold learning tricks, isomaps, and whatever you like, completely fail in representing this kind of shape because measuring the geodesic distance in a graph between these two points would tend to have some overestimated the length for the connection. However, if you do this trick, you keep only the geodesics that once you detect the boundaries, you can keep only the geodesics that actually valid. Again, assuming that you know what the boundary points are. And in many dimensions, it's yeah. So you need to know where the boundaries are, of course. So. Again, we get very good, reasonable reconstruction, even if we just get the tail of the giraffe or the head of the giraffe or whatever, or the crocodile over there. Okay, another question is what would happen if we have topological changes? We mentioned topological change in the previous time, and now what would happen? If we do the trivial thing, that is computing conformal computing the canonical form that I have shown in the first lecture, what would happen is that I would destroy the beauty of the canonical form. Okay, there are now some shortcuts between this point, the point and the leg. So this is what I'm getting instead of getting these beautiful canonical structures. So how could we compensate for that? And here comes into play what is known as diffusion geometry. So instead of using, well, obviously Euclidean geometry would change as I embed myself differently in 3D space. Geodetic distances are fine as long as I don't have shortcuts. And diffusion geometry is a way of averaging between geodesics that are connecting between two points. The formal definition is the following. So we take the Laplace Belframi operator on the surface, and we define the heat operator on the surface. From some reason I get the heat operator on the surface, and if I decompose the Laplace Belframi operator into its eigenfunctions and eigenvalues, I can write the heat kernel, which is exactly an extension of the Gaussian on the surface. And the distance, we then define the distance between two points as the integral over the two kernels, two short time kernels, one of them defined on SI, the other one defined on SJ. Okay, so this is important to understand. This was introduced, by the way, by Kaufman and Lafon. Berard et al. Showed that you can measure Gomov-Hausdorff distances in the Laplace-Beltrami eigendecomposition space. Okay, so this is the square distance between two points using this trick. So you can take eigendecomposition of the operator, compute its just taking the values of this eigenfunction at two points, and summing over the whole differences of the values of each and every eigenfunction, you can get the distance between the two, which is quite a cool idea. This is how the geodesic distance looks like, solving an Eichhorn equation, and the diffusion distance looks like when we are computing the distance from the hand here. And now we will introduce a shortcut that would affect dramatically the geodesic distance, while not so much the diffusion one. Okay, because the diffusion is more or less an average of distances rather than taking the shortest path. Okay, so it has a minor, a less severe effect. And indeed, when we try to separate between objects using the geodesic distances, we get something like that. And when we get the diffusion distance, we can, in fact, so this is the geodesic, this is the diffusion distance. So with the diffusion distance, we are able to isolate all these objects from the rest of the world, the rest of the creatures out there. And the rest of them I've shown you. So now let's go for the treat. And this is shape reconstruction. What kind of so brief run over all shape from X, where X is shading whatever in computer vision. So in computer vision we can treat many problems. For example, if we have a single image, a single light source, then this is called the shape from shading usually. Okay? The shape from shading. If we have two images, okay, taken from two different locations, it is called the shape from stereo problem. And there are some companies that are actually disappearing from the face of the earth, unfortunately, that have dealt with something like that. There is also autostereograms. We have two eyes, we have a single image, like the images here in the corridor where I thought that they were like that, but I cannot extract the 3D out of them. So you have these images that look like noise, random dot stereograms, and then you go to a museum and you look at those images and there is a guy next to you saying, look, there is a dinosaur here. And you spend another 20 minutes looking at these dots and you see nothing. So reconstructing from such an image is called shape from autostereograms. It's actually very easy to do that, because this is a synthesized image, and I will show you how to do that. actually how to synthesize such an image, which is trivial to do, and how to extract the 3D out of it. There is photometric stereo. In photometric stereo, you have a single viewpoint. You light the object from one dimension, from one direction, and then you close the light. You take a new direction. You give another shot at the another flash at the image, and then another one. If you accumulate three of them or two of them, it's called photometric stereo. And I will show you that the solvers for photometric stereo is nothing but a Poisson equation. Okay, so you need to solve a Poisson equation, and there are very fast solvers for that. Then comes structured light. Now take one of the eyes and replace the eye by a different sensor, I mean a projector. So instead of looking with two eyes at the scene, just replace one of the eyes and assume that one of the eyes, for example, is a laser pointer. So I know where the source point is, and I'm pointing there, I'm shooting a ray towards the world. And the other eye looks where this ray is hitting. So if I know exactly the direction at which I'm pointing, I know exactly the distance by triangulation. Now, since this is, as I told you, a one-dimensional problem, instead of shooting one line, I can shoot a plane like that. Okay, a plane that should be that should not align with the line connecting the two focal points. Okay, so I can scan my world with a line, with a plane, and see where this plane is intersecting, and thereby doing the reconstruction. There are other ways. For example, 3DV Systems and Canessa, that were acquired by Microsoft, did the following, did a very nice trick. They did, it's called time of flight. I don't know if I wrote it properly. Yes. Time of flight. And in order to have a clock at the speed of flight, it would be a challenging issue. So what they do is they do the following. This is the object, and this is the camera, and they shoot a pulse, a relatively long pulse. The pulse, so this is the pulse that they are shooting. The pulse hit the object, get the profile, and bounces back. Okay? And this would be the pulse. This is how the pulse would look like when it propagates back. Okay? It would be like that times the albedo of the image. So they need to normalize by the albedo of the image. What they do with the sensor then is open the sensor for a specific amount of time that would accumulate these number of photons. And this would give them the profile of the object. So this is an interesting technology. Since Microsoft is trying so hard, it's a beautiful technology. First of all, it was invented in Israel, so it is a beautiful technology. But by the way, the Kinect that you see in Microsoft was also invented in Israel by a different company, Canessa. PrimeSense. So Microsoft is trying very hard to push PrimeSense away from its core business, so they are trying to push this time of flight into the game. There are many, many problems in this kind of technology, although it is in the, I mean, it was in the market from about 12 years now. My first student was working in this company when it was started up. And then there are other ways of extracting 3D. For example, shape for motion. It's a very nice trick. Assume that you have a single camera and there is an object that is translating in free space. And you track a point on this object, and then you pile the coordinates of this object as it moves in time. So you pile one coordinate, another coordinate, etc., etc. And then you take a decomposition of this matrix by some factorization, SVD. What you get is basically rotation and the shape of the object. So shape for motion up to some factor. So shape for motion is also an interesting concept and interesting idea. Up to a constant, because we don't know what is the scale of the object with respect to the camera. Okay, so the first problem is stereo. In stereo, we have two images. This is how we perceive the world. We have two projections of the world into our two eyes. And then, by correlating the information from the left eye to the right eye, we can triangulate back and know where the point in 3D space exists. Okay, so this is my face some years ago. Two images of the same face. And this is the best you can do in passive stereo. Why? First of all, with faces, everything is smooth, so you can't really do much with the information there. There are some other obvious problems. For example, the fact that there are specularities. Specularities, unlike Lambertian models, change as the viewpoint is changing. Why? Because you can think about it as a semi-mirror effect. Okay, it would change as you change your viewing angle. So these specularities would completely destroy the whole correlation idea. Lack of features would destroy the whole correlation idea. But it is a method, and for example, if you take a passive stereo method and you inject, you color the space with some texture, like shining some light into the scene, then things could really work. Let's go to the auto stereograms. Assume that you have a function, you have your surface, okay? What would be a very trivial way of reconstructing the surface from an image? What you would do is, first of all, project the image and assume that this point is blue and this point is red to the left eye. You do the same to the right eye, and then back projecting them back, you will get the three-dimensional point of each and every point in this function. If you know this method, this reconstruction method, then you can actually synthesize these random dot stereograms. How would you do that? You see that the distance between these points is proportional to the distance of this imaginary plane from the surface. Okay, so when the distance from the imaginary plane is small, then the distance is small. When the distance is large, then the distance between them is large. So what you do is you first of all generate some pattern. It could be random, it could be whatever. And actually there was research about which kind of pattern would be good for the eye to capture the 3D nature of these stereograms. Then you scan your domain from left to right, and you copy a pixel according to the distance from the surface. So if the distance is large, then you go proportionally to the distance. So you go exactly, so if this is 9, you go 9 pixels, or let's say this is 90, you go 90 pixels to the left, and you copy the value of the pixel that was there. Then you move to the next pixel, there is another value, you go back, you copy, you scan the image from left to right, and this is how random dot stereograms are generated. Two lines in MATLAB. So this is a random dot stereogram. Probably you cannot see much from that because there is a lot of light here, but I can tell you that there is a Gaussian over there. I mean, mathematicians that have a notion of what is a Gaussian could probably lock onto that. And the way to generate it is nothing but these three lines in MATLAB that do exactly what I told you before. The stripe size is the size of the random pattern that was initiated at the left, and then it just scans the information from left to right. Okay, you can actually write it in parallel. You don't have to do it. I did it explicitly so that those that are unfamiliar with MATLAB could enjoy the concept. So given this image, how can I reconstruct back? I mean, nobody believes that there is a 3D structure hiding in this image. How can I reconstruct back the 3D structure and use some of the ideas that I have talked about in this short course? So here we have four such images. And I could actually see the 3D in there. Why? Because I have a screen here and I can actually see that. So I could tell you that the top left is a Gaussian structure, is a torus. Then on the right there is egg box. On the bottom left there is a horse, and on the right there is a cup. Okay, so believe me, I just looked at it now. So how should we? And indeed, these are the shapes that are embedded there. So how should we do that? The first naive approach was to say the following: for each and every pixel in this image, go to the left, and find the best match. I mean, you know exactly how long can you go. The distance that you would have to search is exactly the length of the stripe. I mean, it would just be shorter than the stripe. So you should go back and search for all the pixels that look like the pixel itself, and probably some of its neighbors. And then you get the best match. If you do that, this kind of greedy algorithm, then this is the depth profile that you will reconstruct. You will have echoes, you will have difficulties, and actually when you look at these images, in some cases you can see these echoes appearing even by your brain. The suggestion is to say, look, we are looking for the surface that has the minimal area. So how should we minimize area? At each and every pixel, we have several instances. I feel uncomfortable to saying that, but what we are doing here is a graph cut, in a sense. For each point, we have several instances, several possible correlations with pixel on the left. So find the surface, I mean, change the position of each and every assumption that you have such that the area of the surface is minimized. If you do that, apparently 3 or 4 iterations are enough in order for you to capture back almost the perfect reconstruction of the original shapes. Okay, and this is from a random dot serograms looked upon by a computer. Okay, so back to the image, to the simple image formation model that we have used for the Beltrami. So this was the image formation model. And for the time being, let's assume that rho is known, that the albedo is known. So this would be true for the RGB. Again, about correspondence. So as I told you, if you connect the two lines, the two points, the two focal points with the line, then there is you can pass all the possible planes between these two points that are going through this line. This is what is known as the dipolar geometry. And then any point here corresponds to a line here. So when we try to solve the correspondence problem in the stereo scenario, and we have a neighborhood here, what we like to do is find the corresponding neighborhood along the line over there. Okay? The correspondence problem is considered to be a difficult problem to solve, because a little bit of noise completely destroys the stuff. We need to compensate for non-Euclidean transformations of the neighborhoods. And there are some other difficulties. I mean, the moment you have features, everything is nice. The moment you have smooth surfaces, everything falls apart because of obvious reasons. Next comes the another interesting problem, and this is the shape from shading problem. So now assume that all you got is the dot product between the normal and the surface, the normal of the surface and the light source. And from this shading image, you would like to reconstruct back the surface, okay? So this is the equation that you have, okay? So this is actually the cosine of this is the cosine of the angle between the light source direction and the z direction. So if you'd like to reconstruct back z out of this equation, what you need to solve is in fact the Iconal equation. Okay, so Iconal equation, we know how to solve it. You can, by the way, solve it by propagating a line. You can propagate a line where I is the velocity of this line, some function of I. Okay, so the Iconal equation could be solved in a level set of evolution form, or we know by now that fast marching is a much better way to use. Now assume that you take the image, you take various instances of this image, which means that instead of having just the magnitude of the gradient, okay, instead of having only z, in fact, you can have the gradient itself. You can extract back the normal, okay? So if you can extract back the gradient, then going from the gradient back to z, what you need to do, I mean, just solve, just define it as a variational principle. So you get the gradient from these images, two equations. If this is a flat albedo, should be enough in order to extract zx and zy. Three images or four images should be enough for everything else. I mean, you can compensate for the albedo as well. So from gradient of z, if you write the following following functional optimizing for z, what you get is the Laplace. Is the Poisson equation. So this is the P of x and P of y here, where P of x and P of y are the components that we got from the shape from photometric stereo problem, and this is what we have to solve. Okay, so the solution for that, so this is just an example. We got this model that was taken with many, many pictures, and at the end of the day, what we do is solve exactly this equation. So if we don't have any special restrictions and the boundary conditions, then what we can do is nothing but the Fourier transform, okay? We just take the Fourier transform of this F function, divide it by the frequencies squared, and get back the surface. And it works quite well. However, in some cases, we know exactly what is the difference between the nose and one of the eyes. And we would like to inject it back into this equation. Solving it in a spectral domain would not be trivial anymore. Why? Because it is difficult to take this the influence of this restriction over the whole domain. Okay, so now we have these points. Say that I have a laser pointer and I know exactly the distance towards these 6, 8, or 10 points. And I would like to plug it into the Poisson solver. So what we did with Radyovne is use multi-grid method for the solution of this problem. And I will not get to the idea of multi-grid method. The principle in multi-grid method is that I was raised in electrical engineering, and they told me whenever you need to convolve two signals, what you need to do is take the Fourier transform, fast Fourier transform, do multiplication, and go back. And then I met this guy in my department who told me, look, if you need to do it with smooth kernel, I can do it with order of n. Forget about the log of n. How would you up to machine precision? How would you do it? You know that the low frequencies, you need a really rough grid in order to capture them. The high frequency, you need a really high high resolution in order to capture them. So you operate on all of them together. First of all, you solve the problem on your fine grid. Then you propagate the error for your solver to the finer grid, et cetera, et cetera. This is called V cycles. Okay? 5 V cycles, 7 V cycles are more than enough to get your solution if this is a linear problem in no time, up to, I don't know, up to machine precision if this is the issue. So this is what we use. In fact, we didn't use it as it's written here. We used an algebraic approach that propagates the constraints through the grid. It was working quite nicely. Back to shape from shading. Shape from shading, it does appear here with the Cetian. Before we applied, before we started applying Iconal solver to the shape from shading problem, there have been many others. There is the characteristic strip expansion of BKP Horn. Freddy Brookstein used to propagate the level sets, and this is why we started to look into level set methods. Roy and Turin used the minimal cost approach. In fact, they were the first to use the update scheme, and then came the fast marching. So this is regarding reconstructing the shape itself from its gradient magnitude. Okay, so this is shape from shading. And in the early 90s, you could see papers by Roy Turin and Lyons about it. Why? Because it was very nicely fit into the viscosity solutions arena. Now what I usually do is I write the equivalence between the shape from shading and the characteristic strip expansion method, but I think I will skip it. Now I had something else. Okay, so there have been companies like A4Vision at the time that tried to do 3D reconstruction by projecting patterns. I think that A4Vision projected a single pattern. Prime Sensor also projecting a single pattern. And they were Prime Sense were not, as A4Vision was not so successful. Prime Sense was successful. They sold to Microsoft the Kinect, And now they are selling it to Asus and some other companies, and there are some others. I mean, the moment you color your space somehow, you can bypass most of the technological challenges out there. NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology in the U.S., posed the face recognition grand challenge, or the FRVT, which is the vendor test for testing three-dimensional faces. And first of all, they used a really crappy 3D scanner. I think it was Minolta's. And only then they switched into 3DMD, which is a very expensive texture-based 3D scanner. But it gave them really good and accurate sensing of 3D. And actually, you could show that with these results, face recognition was actually almost solved. I mean, most of the problems in face recognition in 3D were not the problem of matching the 3D to itself, but rather hair falling on the and hiding part of the data, or the person moving left to right and actually hiding himself completely. This is how the time of flight used to look. I don't know how it would look in the future when you will buy it. This is the 3DV systems kind of approach, and actually it was we got some samples of that at the time. This is our sensor. I think we talked about it, so let me skip fast. This is the Minister of Science at the time, and we scanned him with the new trick of splitting the space each time with a new pattern. Okay, so this is the binary split that you see over here, and each pattern actually splits the space into two. So 10 patterns should give you a resolution of 2 to the power of 10. In fact, this is not the depth resolution, but rather the number of lines that you have along which you have really accurate estimate of the depth by using the triangulation. And at the end of the day, you can start rotating your minister in 3D space. We built another system that was working on at 3 frames per second. Then we enhanced it to 20 frames per second, and now it should be about 100 frames per second. All based on coded light. This is more or less what is going on here. There are a lot of interesting tricks that we used along the way. I mean, capturing color without projecting color and stuff like that. And what I learned at the end of the day, I mean, when we developed the system, is that in the industry, it's really important to optimize for the cost. Okay, so it's not a total variation, but you will get nowhere if... And I never bothered about it. I mean, it was never an issue for us. And we had a guy that was running this this company, taking the technology from us, who was sitting on each and every bit and pounding on that and saying, look, you need to cut here, you need to cut there. And it was... the process was amazing. Ah, this is not what I want to do. This was how the system looked like 3 years ago. Now it's much better. And you could see that you get sub-millimeter resolution, and it's quite robust, I would say. I mean, there are these, for example, it cannot penetrate the eye, because in the eye you have, the code is not reflected very well. But at the rest of the domain, you get quite good results. And by the way, what we do right now is we optimize for the surface area in order to fill in the missing spots. And apparently minimal area is a really natural, with some relaxation over the boundary, is a really good way of filling in all holes, as well as Beltrami. We also played a little bit with Beltrami. And it's all working in real time, I mean 20 frames per second, a couple of iterations of the Beltrami. Here you can see a 3-LED DLP. DLP is what you have over here. It's an interesting technology. I don't know if you're familiar with that. DLP is a matrix that TI developed of about 1,000 by 1,000 small mirrors that vibrate really, really fast. You shine it with light at one direction, and if the mirror is pointing towards the lens, then the light is going towards the screen. Okay? So you can vibrate these mirrors really fast at a rate of about 10 kilohertz or something like that. And the number of the ratio between the angle by which the light is projected to the screen to the ratio that the light is projected to a black hole in the projector determines how much intensity is projected to the screen. In previous screens. In previous projectors, you had a color wheel that was rotating and projecting red, green, and blue in sequential order. And our eyes integrated the RGB plane into a color image. Now, they do actually also time multiplexing, so they project RGB. But in most of the modern projectors, you have three LEDs that do the projection. And if you take the really tiny projectors, you also have LEDs over there still with the DLP trick. That's it, more or less. I mean, if you have questions, then. Look, if the time of flight would succeed, then it could be interesting. There are many obvious problems over there. I mean, you need to shine with a lot of photons. What happens is that you have a single source and then you project this pulse and it dissipates and then it hits an object and dissipates away. So there are problems there. I think my personal view is that coded light, the way that we are doing that, is the best way to go. Because there is a really nice property about it. You get code per pixel, and this code per pixel is actually determines the depth that you are from the camera. In all the rest of the methods, you need some support. I mean, so we pay for temporal support. We pay by temporal support for losing spatial support. And projecting patterns very fast is much cheaper than producing high-resolution cameras that are really sensitive to low intensities. So I think that coded light, I mean, for commodities, for putting such a sensor in your car and on your TV so that you will be able to do something and the sensor would still be able to see what you do, I think that coded light is the... But again, I can talk about it for hours because I have good experience explaining that to others. But again, you can see that if you really like the hand resolution from a distance of about 1.5-2 meters, then you need to do something better than what is going on today. Today, this is a single pattern. Both time of flight as well as a single pattern projector use a single pattern, and you have difficulties over there. So multi-pattern could come for a rescue. Yes. So you have one code and another code and another code and you construct your information by projecting one code after the other. Well, with Kinect, this is what you are doing. In Kinect, in Microsoft Kinect, you're shooting a laser to the eye. There is a laser over there. There is a small chip which is called DOE. Diffractive optical element that takes the ray, the laser ray, and rebuild it so that it would shine the world with many, many, many points, like a constellation of stars. If you look at each of these stars, it is exactly epsilon below the amount that is allowed to penetrate the eye. Okay? So if, for example, you break the glass in front of the Kinect and put a match over there, you will light the match. And I don't suggest that you would do that. Well, of course, if it would light the match, I wouldn't suggest that you would put your eye over there. By the way, it's very safe. I mean, we use it, people are using it all over the world. I didn't hear of any complaints so far. I mean, if you buy a gun, you don't shoot your leg with that. Right now, we don't know, I mean, nobody is doing temporal smoothing, if this was your question. How does it track? What Microsoft are doing are several things. First of all, they're trying to extract the skeleton somehow. Okay? So for that, they need a good initialization. The good initialization is usually coming from very simple features that they are computing for each and every point. And there is a huge issue of how to train these features and how to... There is a group, I think, in Oxford, Shatton is one of the leaders of this group, that are doing... they are training... It's called random forests. They're taking these kind of features, and they have a tree of decisions. And when you get to the bottom of the tree, this tree of decision has about 30 levels. And when you get to the bottom, you know if what you're looking at is a hand or a torso or whatever, or the head. Brute force learning. It's like if you know how the Viola Jones face detection is working, then this is very... all of us were working in computer vision by applying geometrical tools and refining them and fine-tuning them. And then came Viola and Jones, the face detection trick. What they do is they say the following. Take the most stupid feature that you can think of in an image. Take boxes of black and white, I mean average along one square subtracted from the other. I mean, the simplest multi-resolution derivative and second-order derivative. These are the features that they take. They can compute them really fast by using integral imaging. You just take the integral and touch four points, and you know exactly what is the average inside the rectangle. And then with this feature, you train something. You prune away all the non-faces, one feature by one. You do that by a method which is known as AdaBoost. So you have really stupid classifiers that operate one by one. You throw away all the non-faces, and what you are left with is an image. This method was working so well, so that everybody that was dealing with the face detection and images using some sort of clever geometrical approaches completely lost interest in this problem. So this was a disaster from the point of view of all those that have geometry and function and stuff like that. But you know, it showed us that in order to solve a relatively complicated problem, you can learn from various examples, and then you tune your recognition process to work exactly with that. So most of the cameras that you have that know how to detect faces in the camera use this Viola Jones algorithm. They would not tell you that this is the Viola Jones because there is a patent that I think HP sold to somehow. It's running about, but. This is the Viola Jones algorithm, and this is how it works. So in the Kinect, there is a similar method to do that. It takes a lot of servers and many hours to train them, at least according to the reports that they are writing, and people are working on making it more efficient so that, for example, if you'd like to limit yourself to a specific gesture, you will not have to go through the whole process of training, and you should be able to do it quite efficiently. More.
All right, so that's it for the week. Thanks, Ron, very much.
Thank you.